Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
War is afoot.
I am to inherit the Iron Throne. She will block my way.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching, the television podcast from Vanity Fair. We cover entire seasons of the hottest shows on television, and right now we are diving deep into the hottest of them all, House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones prequel series on HBO. I'm Josh Wigler, and to discuss House of the Dragon episode 5 with me, back from his trip across the narrow sea, it's Richard Lawson. Richard, welcome home.
Hello, thank you. Yeah, I was in the very, very narrow seas of Venice, which I guess we just call canals.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Gosh, I have so many questions for you about Venice. I want to know if you can confirm, did he spit on him or not? Did he do it?
I handle all of Chris Pine's wardrobe, so I inspected it heavily afterward, and I didn't see anything, but who knows?
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Richard, welcome back to the podcast. You have been missed, and you have missed a few big weeks of House of the Dragon here on the pod. And of course, here we are in episode 5, the midpoint of season 1 of House of the Dragon. We light the way. Another doozy. So how are you feeling at this point in House of the Dragon? Any catch-up thoughts that you wanna toss out there before we're talking about episode 5?
I mean, I do appreciate, just like I went back and rewatched 4 in it, and you know, and 5 in anticipation of recording with you. And like, you know, I had said something in my review where, like, you know, characters say something and then 2 scenes later, the consequences of that are seen. And I kind of missed the slower story building of the original Game of Thrones series. But actually rewatching 5, I was like, you know what? They actually have been building toward a lot of this gradually from episode 1. So this episode felt like a big payoff. I'm glad that I'm here to record for this one, because a lot happens, and I feel like it's going to change the DNA of the show pretty significantly going forward in the back half.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair assessment of where we're going, and I think certainly a fair assessment of where we've been and where this one you know, sort of takes us, and what it's punctuating. So much of the show up to this point has been about Princess Rhaenyra and her duty and her claim to the throne as it was solidified at the end of episode 1. But is it solidified? And are there people out there who are going to be contesting that claim? Will she be able to repair her relationship with Alicent, for instance? This episode, by the end of it, really gives you a pretty big indication of just how far that friendship has fallen and the really, really gruesome consequences for a bunch of the players on the board as well. Not to mention, Richard, Viserys, he's on the ground. That doesn't look particularly great for the guy.
But he'd been doing so well. His health seemed great. You know, he was, yeah, you know, rosy cheeked and active. And no, I mean, God bless the actor Paddy Considine, who has, I think, subtly, you know, led us into Viserys's decline. And then in this episode, he just falls off a cliff, which, like, is sometimes how these things go. And yeah, I fear that we might be at the end of him.
Yeah, it's a really grim look for King Viserys. We would be, I think, sad to lose Paddy Considine from the show, but some version of really horrible things befalling this character feels inevitable, feels telegraphed to the point that very early in this episode, in one of his few scenes, I think his only scene of the episode, outgoing hand of the king, Otto Hightower, even he says that man is not destined to be old. That is not a place that he is going to go. So, yeah, it does not look good for King Viserys by the end of this one.
Which, you know, really, that there is a tension that mounting in this season that referenced often by Hightower or Rhaenys in this episode, that like once this succession actually starts to move into gear, you know, that's when things are going to get really bad. And now that worried about things seems basically on the verge of happening.
Yeah, I think there's a really telling line in this episode during the welcome feast. Really, which ends up seemingly being the wedding reception. The big plans seem to have been kind of condensed to that one night, given how everything goes. But there's that dance between Rhaenyra and Laenor, where she says, "I'm not much of a dancer." And Laenor says, "It's not that different from combat." She says, "I hope this has a different outcome." It is not coincidental, I think, Richard, that the period of Westeros that we're adapting for this show, it is called the Dance of the Dragons. So get your dancing shoes on. I think we might be there.
You know, for people who have been, you know, had a wedding before, know that you always have to have a rain plan just, you know, in case the weather turns bad, if it's an outdoor wedding. And in this case, it seems like they had in case the husband's boyfriend is killed by the wife's boyfriend.
Secret boyfriend.
We're going to do it in a small room that night. You
know? I think these kinds of contingencies you need to have in place in the Seven Kingdoms. Yeah,
it's just practical.
It really is. So, of course, we're going to talk about all of that. We, of course, want to hear from all of you out there. You want to write in? You want to send in some feedback? We've got a line for that. StillWatchingPod@gmail.com. That's StillWatchingPod@gmail.com. In many ways, this episode feels like a really significant point in the story, perhaps even the end of an era. We want to know what you're thinking about the show halfway through season one. Please send in that feedback, what you're thinking of these first five episodes of House of the Dragon, how it's stacking against Game of Thrones so far. Is it meeting, exceeding, not quite meeting your expectations? All of that good stuff. StillWatchingPod@gmail.com. Richard and I are going to recap the entire episode scene by scene in just a beat. But first, we're going to take a quick break. We will be right back.
I'm Nomi Fry, and this week on Critics at Large, we're talking about the delights and shortcomings of the new movie Challengers. It starred Zendaya at the center of a tennis triangle, and a very steamy love triangle.
Who are her loyalties to? Will she be tempted by the other one? How do these guys reckon their professional playing ambition with their romantic and sexual feelings about this mysterious woman? And such we have it. We have a conflict between three people in a game meant for two.
Is it a sports movie or a sex movie? Find out on Critics at Large from The New Yorker. New episodes drop every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, Richard, it's episode 5. We Light the Way is the name of this one. And we begin the way through this episode in the Vale, a very recognizable location from Game of Thrones. First time we are seeing it here on House of the Dragon, and we are here for just a quick little murder, just a real brief, it's been a minute, we need a murder, we want to start with a murder, here's a murder.
Yeah, and it's sad because, you know, this episode introduces us to two interesting characters who are then summarily killed off, which is a shame. And I really like this introduction to Damon's wife, but it was a short-lived cameo of sorts.
Yes. Rachel Redford is the actor who plays Lady Rhea of House Royce. She is the Lady of Runestone. And this is Daemon's wife, who we have not heard such glowing things about from Daemon's really terrible perspective. And what he has said about the women of the Vale largely over the course of the show has been awful. And I think in meeting this woman, I think that this is one of the things that Game of Thrones used to do so well. You know, I'm rewatching season one of Game of Thrones right now for my sins, Richard, because I can't get away from Westeros, I suppose. And there's so many characters in that first season who are done in one. They're either in an episode and that's it, or they're in just a couple of episodes and then they're gone very quickly. Your Cereo Pharrells, your Yorins of the Night's Watch. And I feel like they give us a character here in this opening scene who you would want to watch the Rhea Royce show. She's very, very loaded with character. She's got the bow. She's riding so confidently. And it just so happens that she's married to this terrible, terrible dragon prince who just wants her money and to be free and clear to marry whoever he wants. And so murder occurs.
But yeah, I think her introduction and, you know, a brief spell on the show, Damon has described her a certain way. And then you meet her and she's a seemingly independent, interesting person who, you know, her country or the local people seem to like her, you know, at least this one cousin. And you're like, of course, that's how he would see her. There's someone who doesn't just like, you know, stand meekly and, you know, daintily in a corner becomes, you know, uglier than the sheep and all this stuff. And I think it's just a further kind of explication of like Damon's psychology. And I think particularly his view toward women.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really telling you a lot about Damon. And, you know, it's again, this is a character who is remarkably compelling and also repugnant. And that is another thing that Game of Thrones does well. And can it hold your interest when somebody is just this despicable, when he is just scaring this horse to murder his wife and it doesn't go all the way? And she has that final line, "I knew you couldn't finish." And there comes the rock and there comes the killing blow. This play is a little different in the book, Richard. She certainly dies, and Damon certainly sets his sights on, well, now I want to go and scoop up all of her riches now that she's gone. But I think the timeline of did he kill her, it's certainly not suggested that he did in the book. To my recollection, I just went back and checked out the passage. But I don't think it's a far leap out of character to put this in the show. I do not think that it is anywhere outside the vicinity of what Daemon Targaryen is all about for him to be the one who actively kills Rhea. In the book, it's a hunting accident. On the show, it's much more than that.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, for the purposes of television, like, the look on her face when she realizes what he's going to do, like, oh, that's the path you see to get, you know, onto the throne. It's like chilling. And I don't know. I guess you could describe that in a book, but I think maybe inventing that for TV makes sense.
Yeah, it's a good adaptation choice. I agree. So we're going to go across the narrow sea to Driftmark. There's a very quick scene here where we start to see that Viserys is not doing well. He is getting seasick. It could just be seasickness, but we are going to come to see that it is a lot more than that that's going on for the king. We'll have a lot of time to dig deeper into this one. But I kind of want to talk about what's going on with Alicent first. We get this scene where Otto Hightower, he's leaving. He's been fired as Hand of the King. It's his final day. He's about to commute back home to Old Town. And he has some parting advice for Alicent, who he says, OK, so you chose Rhaenyra. That's great. That was actually a very bad decision. And it's so bad because if Rhaenyra ends up on the Iron Throne, war is going to follow. The people of the realm, they're not going to accept her. And in order to secure her claim, she's going to kill you and your children. She'll have no choice. You know it. You're no fool, yet you choose not to see it. The time is coming. You have to prepare Aegon to rule, or you want to cling to Rhaenyra and start praying for her mercy. And this is a very, very, very scary thing for Alicent to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. It's, you know, because Alicent, you know, in this episode is learning that she's been lied to, that her friendship with Rhaenyra, as old as it might be, is on very, you know, tenuous ground. And I think any time you see in stories like this where, or even a mob story or whatever, where people all of a sudden wake up and realize, oh, I've gotten really far into this and there's not like a safe way out, you know, and
right.
I think she thought, well, you know, we're just kind of ladies of the court and we hang out and we wear dresses and we do this. And sure, we want more, but like, we're safe. And her realizing quite profoundly that, like, not only am I not safe, but I've been pushed into a really precarious position by pretty much everyone I know.
Yeah, which is going to be echoed in what's going on at Driftmark with Rhaenys, who's going to be telling her husband in a couple minutes, we're going into the lion's den here, or the dragon's den, as it were. We do not need to be doing this, and we are actively endangering ourselves. So at least she is vocalizing that idea that you're talking about, for sure. Very quickly, still with Alicent, just to stay with her for a bit. She's alone, right? You know, everybody else is on this expedition to Driftmark, and she's staying behind, and she's still been left with the uncertainty of what happened with Rhaenyra, what happened with Damon, what happened with that entire situation. And here comes Laris Strong, Clubfoot, a character you and I have not yet talked about. But this is the same guy who is eating biscuits at the camp in episode 3. He's finally really speaking up here. And it seems like he has a little bit of pot stirring that he wants to do here. He talks about an outsider among the natives as he's looking at this flower that's indigenous to Braavos, yet thriving here for mysterious reasons. Maybe alluding to Allison, maybe alluding to his own place in this political cycle, but he's trying to pass along some information to Allison as subtly as a hammer, as he talks about the tea that was brought to Rhaenyra's chambers. And this really, really rattles Allison in a big way.
Yeah, and you know, poor sweet naive Allison, I don't necessarily realizes that she's being manipulated by yet another person, you know, like she kind of thinks that he maybe doesn't know what he's talking about, and she's right. Putting the pieces together. But of course, Laris knows exactly what he's doing. And I guess, you know, I know you're familiar with the book. I've not read it. My hunch is that Laris is going to become, you know, is going to be stick around, you know, like because clearly he's got some agenda going on, sort of this Richard III-esque figure. So I'm curious about, you know, whether he's just a little piece of the puzzle kind of moving the plot forward, or if we're going to see the kind of fullness of his ambition later on.
Yeah, what I'll say is I've been really eager to see Laris Clubfoot. I've been really eager to see this character. He's a really compelling figure in the way he's written by Martin in Fire and Blood, the book this show is based on. Someone who I've been really fascinated to see, how is he going to be depicted on the show? How is he going to be used on the show? And this episode is really the biggest taste of it we've gotten so far. And because there are so many characters, and because we're just starting out, we're 5 weeks into this adventure right now. For those who haven't done the research, or if the show hasn't made it clear enough, just to connect the family tree, Laris is the son of Lionel Strong, who had been Master of Laws, now the new Hand of the King. Probably a strong choice, literally, to be Hand of the King, given the advice that he has given Viserys in the past. And the other member of that family that we know is Harwin Strong, Breakbones, who we've seen glimpses of as well. We saw him. He's the one who's smiling goofily at Rhaenyra when she brings the boar back to camp back in episode 3. He's the knight that runs into Rhaenyra in the streets of King's Landing in last week's episode. He's the knight who Lionel gives the nod to go and help break up the fight at the wedding feast at the end of this episode as well. So the three of those characters are all connected, and I think that they're compellingly so because I feel like they represent very different types of people. The two brothers especially. One is considered, his name is Breakbones because he's considered the strongest man in Westeros. The other one is talking about being an outsider, right? You know, he's basically discussing himself. I don't know that I necessarily belong here, but let's see if I can't find a way to thrive.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's fun to see more and more pieces arrayed on this board, you know, because I think in the early episodes of this season, I was worried, okay, we're so Targaryen heavy with a few, you know, interventions from a Hightower here or a Valyrian there. But like now to have this other family kind of, because everyone is crouching in anticipation about what's about to happen, you know, they right. can see that the king is ill with, not grayscale, it's not any of the other, you know, Westerosi diseases that I'm familiar with, but like it's something. And so everyone is just making sure that they are best positioned. And I think that's tense and exciting to watch.
Yeah. One of the conditions that Viserys suffers from in the book, Richard, is the king's disease, is gout. And as someone who also occasionally suffers from gout myself, God, I hope that's not what's waiting for me. Oh, no. It looks pretty, pretty grim what's going on with Viserys as he is. He's really sick on this voyage to Driftmark, and he is coming here to smooth things over with the Sea Snake, to, you know, arrange this marriage between Rhaenyra and Laenor, to maybe undo some of the damage that had been done in their relationship previously, and coming directly himself to really solidify this, to show how serious he is about it, but at great physical cost. And the Sea Snake really teasing that out as well. Pretty rude of the Sea Snake to not be there when Viserys shows up, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah. I was really intrigued by the dynamic of this discussion, you know, of like the terms of the arrangement. Obviously, the king was not going to, you know, concede the last name thing or whatever. But like, obviously, this is good in the very, very short term for the Sea Snake and his family, but also, as is later pointed out by his wife, like very, very dangerous, possibly. And right. So I'm just, I guess maybe their backs, they feel they're up against a wall to some extent, but like, I like that it's not a sort of like, that they're aware of all the possible facets, all the possible outcomes here. They're not just thinking in, you know, unilaterally in like, okay, good, we're going to be, get our son into the center of power.
Right. I think, you know, the sea snake, it's, you know, it's, if it's gone unnoticed by certain people, it's worth emphasizing. He is this, you know, really seasoned, experienced adventurer. He has seen, you know, we hear from Rainier when she and Kristen are going to be talking on the boat a little while from now about what you want me to just like sail off with you all the way to a shy. He's been there. The sea snake has. He's been there. He has been everywhere. He has built his house in a really very real way on the riches that he's accumulated over the course of many of these adventures, so much so that HBO reportedly wants to make a show about it. It's one of the possible successor shows that's still in development, is one about the young version of the sea snake. So we think that there is a fearlessness to him. There is a decisiveness to him as well. He even mentioned it back in episode two when he tells Viserys that you can either sail around a storm or you can sail right into it, but you should never await its coming. And so maybe sensing the, you know, the stakes of the danger in the air right now, if he's looking at the situation the same way that Otto Hightower is, for instance, that when Viserys goes and Rhaenyra is the person who has been named as heir and is going to ascend to the Iron Throne, and if the realm really isn't going to accept that, where does he want to be within that? It sounds to me like he would like to sail right into that storm. And perhaps yeah. Rhaenys, who is experienced in this, having almost been the queen of Westeros herself once upon a time, feels like, you know what? I would much prefer sailing around the storm. I was in the Eye of the Storm. Let me tell you about the Eye of the Storm. Overrated. Not so great.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think these scenes establish really well. I mean, this whole episode does that there are no perfect options here. You know, there's only like, what do we think? Okay. Thinking four moves ahead, like, you know, we want the high ground, but what does that high ground look like? And who does that align us with? Like, these people in all of their striving have like, you know, kind of brought this all on themselves in a way. And so there's something a little bit, not Schadenfreude-esque, but deserved about it. You know, it's like, you've all been jockeying for this and here's what's going to, you know, here's the mess that you're going to make of it and already have made of it. And I think it's interesting to watch, you know, consequence close in around them.
Yeah, absolutely. One other note from what's going on with the sea snake and Rhaenys, once they get a moment to talk, did you catch that the sea snake has apparently just collected the crab feeder's mask as a trophy? I feel like that's kind of grim, that's just in his throne room.
Yeah. Yeah. Considering who the crab feeder was killing, you know, like yeah. it's an odd prize to have, you know, and I guess.
I hope he washed it. You know, it should have been sterilized.
Yeah, right. Well, you can boil it, and then you can
artifact.
If you boil it, you make crab stock with the liquid.
Yeah, a very flavorful soup. Yeah, it takes a lot to make a stew. Okay, so let's talk about Rhaenyra and her betrothed, Ser Laenor, Knight of House Velaryon, son of the Sea Snake and Rhaenys. And Rhaenyra and Laenor are cousins, so they are related. This is now an improvement over uncle and niece, and an improvement over sister and 2-year-old brother, if nothing else, Richard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, their walk on the beach is, I think, a really sweet and sort of, you know, nimbly written scene where, you know, Rhaenyra is like, you're gay and that's okay.
Right.
Like, I also have my own thing going on. So let's just like, we've known each other our whole lives. Let's just like do this thing for our parents. And then we'll just be friends. We'll hang out. And it, like, you know, and Laenor seems so relieved by that. And they form this special little bond together. And anytime that happens in the world of George R. R. Martin, you know, it's going to be short lived, you know,
yeah,
like
there are no
any moment of sweet, any moment of sweetness is going to be very violently challenged. Probably, you know, a few scenes later.
I mean, it does happen within this episode, right, that his boyfriend is going to be horribly killed by Ser Criston.
Yeah.
So it's like really, really short lived. Was the pacing of that surprising to you, Richard, or does that feel kind of a piece of the pace of the show right now and a pace of the franchise maybe even?
Well, you know, as any of the old school Renly and Loras fans can tell you, we know that this show is going to be particularly hard on any sort of queer romance in the show.
Yes.
And I think that's a little frustrating in a way, but I understand that the death of Joffrey, who is, you know, Laenor's secret boyfriend, is kind of hurling Laenor more into the center of the story, you know, because you have to wonder, like, what this moment on the beach, it seems like he and his, you know, soon to be wife are seeing very eye to eye, but will that change it at all? Like, what's going to happen? So I understand it from a narrative perspective. It's just a shame that, like, we now have at least two in a pattern in the Game of Thrones universe where any sort of gay romance is very violently torn asunder pretty quickly after it's introduced.
Yeah, it's really brutally done. I wrote about this for VF.com. The way that it plays out in the book is different. It happens during we hear that the celebration is going to last for several days, right? That this is the welcome feast. We're going to have 7 days of jousting. It's going to be a tournament, the whole nine yards. And Joffrey goes up against Criston Cole during the tournament, and Criston Cole just unleashes his rage on Joffrey there. And Joffrey lives for, you know, another few days before he passes, and Laenor is by his side the whole time. The show did it a lot more graphically and did it a lot faster. Yeah. It did it in the space of a single episode. He's a character that appears, I think, in two sentences in Fire and Blood. But the life that is brought to him on this show by, I believe, the actor is Solly McLeod, who really, I thought, did, even in one episode, Richard, best Joffrey of the Game of Thrones franchise, I think, decidedly.
yes.
I guess depending on your love to hate status.
He's still kind of an asshole, you know. And also, again, like talking about Rhaenys and the Sea Dragon, talking about like, okay, like, are we hurling ourselves into danger here? Like, and you know, maybe all of this was unnecessary. They could have just enjoyed their own sort of place in the ecosystem of Westeros and not gotten overextended by trying to put themselves very much at the center of power. And like, here you have Joffrey. It's like, just don't say anything. What are you doing? Like you're making this worse and worse and worse. And so these people are all kind of power mad, and they, you know, they're going to suffer the consequences either immediately in the case of Joffrey or later on in the case of, I'm sure, many of these other characters. So it's frustrating, but it's also like, just this is who these people are, and this is how they've gotten to this position.
Not to I feel like it's worth pointing out as well. We talked a couple minutes ago about the sea snake's old wisdom of you sail into the storm or you sail around it, but you must never ignore it at all costs. And there's this moment between him and his wife in the throne room where he's saying Rhaenyra is a great match. He must be really excited. Laenor must be so excited. She's gotten more comely in the years since then. And Rhaenys is trying to say, you know, our son is gay, right? This is not a thing that he's going to be super excited about. And you even see the sea snake is, you know, classically trying to ignore it, or he'll grow out of it and everything. So adding further tragedy to the whole situation, for sure.
And that stubbornness and that refusal to like see the whole of the truth seems to be kind of Corlys's Achilles heel right now. You know,
yes.
like he's going to keep getting into trouble if he's going to be so prideful. And you know, I think that it's telling that Rhaenys, who has had her own losses, her own failures, her own regrets in the past, is much more attuned to like the nuances of things than her husband is. You know, she's like, look, things don't always work out exactly as you want them to, and we have to be able to be adaptable. And like, we're fixing this with our son to some extent. All I'm saying is, don't expect him to have some like glorious sex life with his new wife. Like, that's not going to happen, but everything else could work out, maybe, you know?
Yeah.
But he doesn't see it that way. Everything has to be exactly as he wants it to be.
Well, it also, it's again another crusade. You know, the way that he talks to Rhaenys about this is, by all rights, you should be the queen of the Seven Kingdoms. You were robbed of the crown. I want to remedy the small-minded error of the rest of the realm by any means necessary. Small-minded error is a really long way to say the misogyny of the realm.
Right.
But, you know, he feels very strongly about, you were wronged and I'm going to right it. That attitude, Richard, I have found fairly works out terribly well for people. people, but we'll see. We'll see how that works out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to leave Driftmark. We're leaving with a marriage pact. We're leaving with a very ill Viserys, and we are leaving with a Sir Criston Cole having an existential crisis, Richard. He essentially is going to, in the cold light of day at dawn, he's going to find Rhaenyra on the ship and, very boldly talk about, I have a plan. We could go to Essos. I want to see what is beyond Westeros. We could be nameless. We could be free to go wherever we like, love how we like. You could marry me, a marriage for love and not for the crown. She is all but just saying hard pass, in right. this moment. I am the dragon. You think I'm going to give that up for you? This is a tough read for Sir Criston Cole. This gives him a whole lot of existential dread that happens in this moment where he realizes, what did I just break my oath for?
Right, right, yeah, and the poignancy of in any story like this, any classical tragedy, you almost kind of narratively have to, at least for a moment, introduce the alternative, like, what if we did just go and lived on our own and left all of this behind? It presents a possibility that I think a lot of these people have never even considered, that like there is a place somewhere. I mean, it's very West Side Story, somewhere out there, like there is a life that would be ours and
right.
free of all of this conflict. And you always know, because it is a trope of tragedy, that one of the parties is not going to agree to it, because they're not going to, it's not going to be acceptable, or it will seem too impossible. And so we know that that's the refusal is coming, certainly, but it still registers painfully, because you start to think about it and you're like, yeah, that does sound a lot better. If these were real people, I would tell them, please do exactly what Cole said.
Oh,
he wanted
yes.
to do.
Yeah. There's definitely, the show is ongoing. We're in episode 5. We've no idea how many episodes long term we are going to have on House of the Dragon. But safe to call this one yet another inflection point, maybe, if you just went after that orange and cinnamon dream that Criston is talking about, we could have called it at 5 episodes and had a really yeah. nice limited series.
they hop in a little rowboat from the main ship and just row into the
right.
sunset, and then, credits roll.
They could pull a Galadriel and just jump in, go swimming.
Sure.
They could
yeah.
swim
yeah.
all the way back, for sure. So he is, he takes this very, very poorly. He says, so what? I'm just your whore. That's how you view me. And she says, no, I want us to keep going. I want you to be my sworn protector, my white knight. And I don't know if this is, is this communication breakdown? Is this really just wrongheaded from both of them? But either way, it is a collapse of the relationship at this moment in time, at the very least.
And it sets the table for what comes to at the very end of this episode, or toward the very end, where we now have two young people deeply devoted to Rhaenyra, who have pretty brutally realized like where they stand in her estimation,
right.
Like, oh, we're not actually allies. Allison is not. And Criston is not, they are important to her. But is it sort of selfish and strategic more than it is, equal? And I think those twin realizations in this episode obviously are going to come to bear pretty heavily narratively going forward.
100%. So let's put those two characters together, because when the ship pulls in, Viserys collapses. He held it together as long as he could. He's going to be taken to his chambers, and we'll check in on him in a moment. But first, Alicent, the queen, who is trying to figure out, okay, did I get this wrong? Was Rhaenyra lying to me? I want to vet this further. Sir Criston is her sworn protector, stands outside her chambers all night long. He would know. And so she brings him to her chambers and says, so this is all that I've got. Let me just like draw it out. And he's like, I did it. It was me. I did it. I'm the one. And he spills like chunking Goonies. He tells her everything.
Yeah. I've seen that scene a couple times now. What I can't quite suss out is like, is there relief in Allison at that moment where she's like, oh, they're just like, it's just some young love situation, or is she just seeing more of the bad picture of Rhaenyra, develop?
Right. I think that the way that this reads to me in this moment is, she's trying to figure out on her radar, what she is trying to figure out is there is this rumor. There's this source that told her father, who went to the king and got fired over giving this news report about Daemon and Rhaenyra being together. She's now heard about the tea as well, which flies in the face of Rhaenyra telling Alicent, "I swear on my mother, nothing happened." So she's vetting that story further with Kristen. And when Kristen cops to being the one who slept with Rhaenyra, it's the answer that she feared, and yet the answer that she didn't even know was an answer to a question that she wasn't even thinking to ask, that it could be this person, that it could be this man. And just in discharging him in this moment when he, you know, consumed with guilt, consumed with, you know, this existential crisis of, please don't geld me, but yeah, you can kill me. I broke my oaths. I deserve to die. She just sends him on his way. And I think it's in this moment, the pain is so close to the surface that she's not thinking any deeper about, well, what will happen between me and Sir Criston Cole? You know, what do I do with this knowledge of what Sir Criston Cole did? The hurt is just so right there. The injury has just occurred in the deepest of ways.
Yeah. And you know, she's been lied to. And I guess, you know, Rhaenyra could maybe sort of flip it around if they were to have some sort of confrontation. Maybe they will. I don't know. Where it was like, well, you went behind my back and married my father. But like, Alicent didn't really have any agency in that decision, you know?
Correct, yeah.
No. So she's kind of emerging as one of the more egregiously wronged characters in this show, you know? She's been lied to, she's been forced into a strategic marriage that has now kind of blown up in everyone's faces and put her at great risk. And I'm really curious to see what's next for her. I mean, it's my hunch, given the way this episode ends, that we might be arriving at the time jump with the new actors that we talked about early on in the season.
Okay.
Yeah. We are halfway through. It would be kind of a neat punctuation point.
Sure. But there are main cast series regulars who have yet to appear on the show, you know, front build characters. So, you know, you would think with 5 episodes left, maybe they're going to start showing up.
Especially because Olivia Cooke, who is going to play older Alicent, like, is one of the namier actors in the series, from what I, you know.
Right.
You know, you have Reese Ifans, obviously, but like there are some bigger names, Eve Best, but like Olivia Cooke's been like kind of a up and coming actor for a while now, and I would assume that means that Alicent, in whatever episode Olivia Cooke pops up in, is going to be pretty central to the story, and I think they've laid that groundwork very subtly, whereas a lot of the other stuff with like Daemon and Rhaenyra herself has been a bit more, you know, direct and blunt. But with Alicent, we're seeing a long payoff of like, here's where this character was being positioned, because actually a lot of our empathy is now supposed to be placed on her, which I think is a fascinating development.
Well, I think it's really smartly told, right? Because Alicent's journey is such a lonely one. You know, she is, you know, who are her allies? It was Rhaenyra, and she's lost that friendship because of circumstances, you know, mostly largely beyond her control, if not completely beyond her control. Is it her father who has just been fired, but also he pimped her out to the king? Is it the king who is this, you know, sore covered man who maybe sometimes is a nice enough guy, but also super gross, and this is gross, and he's also spineless a lot of the time? She doesn't have the, you know, the people that maybe Rhaenyra has. She doesn't have even the people that Daemon has on the battlefield. Her story is such a lonely one that I think that the way that the show has rolled her story out matches the loneliness of her journey. That it has been such a long haul to get deeper into Alicent's level of thinking. And when she's going to make her grand arrival at the welcome ceremony a couple of scenes from now, it's like she's showing up on the show for the first time in some way.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, I mean, I obviously, like, nothing matches up one to one, but like, you see a lot of Sansa Stark in her at this point. You see some Jon Snow in some ways, like isolated, you know. Sort of has a familial shame now that Hightower has been dismissed, you know. So Game of Thrones is not always just about like bloodthirsty, power mad people. Like there are at least one or two in any given season or any given episode, people who have a little more decency, and I think the audience are supposed to sympathize with. And clearly, Alicent is going to be that figure. What I will be curious to see going forward, now that we've had this huge inflection point on the show, is, does she become as bloodthirsty as the rest of them, or does she remain a bit more, not innocent exactly, but, you know, gentle?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great observation. I think it's very easy to compare her, since she is the queen of Westeros, to another queen of Westeros who we have known in Cersei. And we don't see Cersei as a young person, except for the one time where you see this weird flashback scene that usually never happens on Game of Thrones, and yet they did it once upon a time. It was strange, the Maggie the Frog of it all. But you don't see her story when she was married to Robert. You hear about it. You hear about those days, and you see a lot of that lovelessness and frankly abuse in the relationship between the two of them during season one of Game of Thrones. But when you think about the situation that Cersei herself was thrust into, it was terrible. And I think in Alicent, right now we are getting a chance to kind of see what that process may have looked like for a character who, as delicious as a performance as Lena Headey gave as Cersei Lannister throughout much of Game of Thrones, she's typically a loathsome character and does so many loathsome things. But what predated that, I guess, is the question. And I think to some extent there's this bit of the queen's origin story happening with yeah. Alicent that I think they've done really interestingly here.
And what will that mean, you know, if we do jump ahead in time, next episode, let's say, you know, how old is Aegon going to be? How old is that son of hers going to be?
Right.
And will we see the sort of fierce protectiveness and, you know, that Cersei exhibited? You know, she had one loathsome child that who she like would, you know, burn the whole city down for if she had to, you know, and will that be the route that Alicent kind of develops into, or will it be something else? Will we root for her going forward? I don't know. But all of a sudden, she's really emerged as, I think, the most interesting character for me on the show.
So one last scene before we are in wedding mode for the rest of it is Viserys in his chambers looking rough. And I just want to present one of the most harrowing sentences I've ever heard in my life. This is from one of the maesters who says, "Rest now, your grace. I will bring the leeches." Not what I want to hear when I'm feeling sick.
No. But it apparently gives him great comfort. So, you know, look, I'm not going to yuck anyone's yum. So
this other guy's like, you know, maybe modern medicine. Do we want to do like a poultice? Maybe he's like, no, right. He loves the leeches.
Yeah.
He's into them. Trust me. He loves the leeches.
You know, there's a hospital in Old Town we could just take him to. But
yeah, we could just get on a dragon and go.
Yeah.
So he looks awful. His arm looks awful. His, you know, his color is drained. He just looks so ill. And he is, yet again, this is the story of the day, Richard. It is another existential crisis. He is wondering about his place in history. He's saying, will I be remembered as a good king? Hundreds of years from now, will they be singing stories about me, singing songs about me at feasts? I often thought that I wished that I'd been tested. I had no great victories. I have no great defeats. I wish I'd been tested. I often think that in the Crucible, I may have been forged a different man. And I love this scene very much because this poor fool does not realize he is in the Crucible. He is there right now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's just coming toward the end of what looks to be the end of his life. And the results of his legacy or the real legacy, he probably won't live to see, because by nature, his most important act is one that will only really come to fruition once he's dead. You know, it was a big deal that he made his successor the first ever, you know, potential female ruler of this country. And that's big. And maybe, you know, I don't think things are going to go very well in terms of that handover transfer of power.
Well, it gives you the sense of that. It's, well, you know, I don't know.
Maybe the back half is like kind of a workplace comedy. I don't know. But, you know, and, you know, I'm sure that there would be plenty of people in Westeros years, you know, after this who would be like, yeah, it led to a whole big mess, but like, good for him for trying. You know, he was trying to help break that glass ceiling. And, you know, he doesn't probably see it exactly that way, but he did make at least one bold, definitive, world-changing choice. It's just one that he won't ever see the results of by its very definition.
It's so compelling to me because I think it is so human to not know when you're in the Crucible, that you're in it. You know, you're so deep in the belly of the beast that you have no idea you've been swallowed up at all. And like, certainly this man is very sick. He's delirious almost. But I think that there is this is it willful ignorance? Does he have more of a sense of where he is, both literally and existentially than he's letting on, that he would care to admit to himself right now? I just thought it was a really fantastically written scene and just performed beautifully by both actors in the scene. I really love what Gavin Spokes is doing as Lionel Strong. And I think that the two of them together in the scene, it was gentle. It was sad. It was tragic as seven hells. I thought it was really, really, really good.
Yeah. And if it is indeed a send off for this character and this actor, it's good. I mean, it's really strong and lends some real human shape to what, you know, is often this season so far is very process oriented, very like, okay, yeah. Then, you know, causality. And this was just a moment of quiet reflection as a character faces, you know, their end.
Okay, so it's time for the welcome ceremony, and it's a blockbuster event. We're going to be here for just about the rest of the episode. Dragons riding high over King's Landing, the Sea Snakes fleet, the whole thing, it looks like, showing up. Everybody, it's a veritable who's who of the Westerati here on a Game of Thrones show, and it's Jason Lannister, both of the Lannister twins. I don't think we've checked in since Lannister twins showed up on the show. Do you have any strong takes about Jason Lannister here?
Well, just that I don't know in this world if you introduce a Lannister or Lannisters plural, that they're just going to be background characters who are there only to be like, oh yeah, like the family that's later in all that power, you know. I would have to imagine that the Lannister project that we see where it is in the original Game of Thrones series probably took a lot of time to build up to, and so maybe we're seeing yet another noble family of great wealth and power starting to sort of throw a hat in the ring. I mean, he already tried kind of with the proposal, but I guess we should keep an eye on him and, you know, any other Lannister that appears.
All Lannisters must be watched. Sir Gerald of the Vale, he shows up. He wants to, I think he wants to speak his piece about what happened to Lady Rhea at the start of this episode. A unique character whose kind is not likely to be seen again, he says. And Rhaenyra is going to address it when it's interrupted by the grand arrival of the Sea Snake, Lord Corlys of House Velaryon, Master of Tides, Lord of Driftmark. It's just a really epic, rollicking introduction. Prince Laenor, future King Consulate, everyone is really, really, you know, everyone's getting up. You know, the crowd is lit here, Richard, for this occasion. And then the tune changes really quickly. There's a big sort of hold my beer energy to this scene where it starts with the Sea Snake. You think you can't top it. Here comes Prince Daemon showing up. He has been kicked out of King's Landing and he did not ask for permission. He's not begging for forgiveness either. And he's just showing up and rolling into town. And the very ill Viserys does not look thrilled to see his brother. And you would think that that would be the showstopper. Queen Alicent rolls up in the greenest of green dresses. As Laris Clubfoot says, the beacon on the high tower of Old Town glows green when they call their banners to war. This is a declaration of war of sorts.
It is. And my question is, and I mean, you know, and I'm sure you know more about this, having read the books, is like, who is Alicent going to align with, you know, or does she maybe not need it? Maybe the high towers and people in Old Town is not a location that we really travel to much at all in Game of Thrones. So we obviously Sam
time there. He's training up. Yep.
But it's like the biggest city in Westeros, and we spend more time in King's Landing. So I'm just curious about what that power looks like, that might looks like, and who it aligns with. And I just, in terms of better understanding the world of this show, like, I'll be curious to see what that green signal really means.
I think one of the things that's worth chewing on as you ponder that question, and anyone out there who's pondering the same who hasn't read this, is what is the might of the Hightower House? What does the might of Old Town actually look like in practice? But you think back to episode 3 when the aforementioned Jason Lannister is telling King Viserys, I would love to marry your daughter. She won't, you know, she'll be well compensated for her loss of station. And him kind of, you know, tipping his hand of the revelation that many of us out here are assuming that you're going to name your son as the heir now that you have a son. And his name happens to be Aegon. And so there is that sentiment. And you even get it when Allison has a moment alone with her uncle. And he says that, you know that Old Town stands with you. There are people who are going to cling for dear life to the patriarchal idea of a man has to sit on the Iron Throne and no chance is a woman going to sit there. Right. And in this move of showing up wearing colors that are decisively from her house, that are decisively of Old Town, decisively of House Hightower, breaks away from Targaryen tradition, you know, in this very, very clear visual signal. And I think that that is this mark of independence for Allison. And what does it mean in terms of who specifically she might be collecting for whatever cause it is she might be championing? At the very least, it seems like her making a choice of the choices that were laid available to her by her father at the start of the episode. Either you win or you die, to paraphrase another Game of Thrones character. So I think that that's the really big takeaway that people should be looking at. I think from my viewpoint of Allison's big arrival here, it's just a marker of breaking away from this house that she's been married off to. It's her first real public act of agency that we've seen from her since she's become the queen.
And, you know, if what happens to Viserys at the very end of this episode is in fact what we think happens, which is that he's dead, she is both in a precarious position, but also freed a bit, you know. She can probably more freely seek out, you know, the counsel of her father, who is a master strategist, and anyone else, you know. She had to kind of be in Viserys's, you know, shadow, but now if he's gone, it kind of activates her that much more.
Right. Monumental moment. I was very excited to see this once I watched it on the screen. It's a little different from how it goes down in the book. In the book, there's this 5-year anniversary of King Viserys and Queen Alicent's wedding. And she is showing up wearing green, and Rhaenyra, who is not the biggest Alicent fan and vice versa at that moment in the story, is showing up in Targaryen black and red. So when you hear about the blacks and the greens, this is something that is commonly associated when you're talking about people who are associated with Rhaenyra and Alicent respectively. It stems from that moment in the book. Notably, I think that the emphasis in the book is on Rhaenyra's attire. The emphasis on the show is very much more on Alicent. So an adaptation choice that I thought visually was really, really striking and quite strong. So the dancing begins here. The Dance of the Dragons. This is the one. This is it. This is what you've heard about. It's not. But it's a good dance scene as we're getting this moment between Laenor and Rhaenyra that we talked about already. This whole conversation of I was never much of a dancer, not that much different from combat. Everybody's watching, and then everybody joins in the dance, and it is this big celebratory atmosphere while House of the Dragon then goes on to do all of the things that you expect from Game of Thrones, right? Like all of the side conversations, all of the secret little intricate wheeling and dealings that occur in between all of these dance moves. We have Daemon being confronted by Sir Royce of Runestone, and him, you know, being just this wicked little bratty prince that he is. Of, oh well, now I believe because she died and we had no kids, I get everything. So I'm going to be flying to the Vale. I'll see you pretty soon, there, Sir Geralt. You know, he clocks his name. That's a pretty dangerous moment. What did you think of this whole scene? The atmosphere, the vibe, the choreography, Richard.
Well, I think, you know, we have the crucial thing of Laenor and Joffrey talking about, like, all right, who's her secret beau, you know? And then, meanwhile, Rhaenyra is not being subtle at all in staring at Kristen, you know, and she will later see exactly what that led to. You know, I think it's another reminder, as evidenced last week with this sort of reckless trip outside the castle and all this other stuff, that like Rhaenyra is shrewd and smart and certainly headstrong, but she's also like, she's not yet good at like the subtler arts of this, of whatever, you know, dance or game she's playing. And that, you know, she's not some perfect portrait of like, just like power made manifest. She makes mistakes. Right. She's messy. And I think that's a really important kind of character detail to keep in mind about her. And you know, there's a kind of a witlessness about her that, like, you know, she is in the position to cause great harm to people, and she wields that kind of unconsciously and unthoughtfully. And obviously that's what happens in this scene, because she gives up the ghost. She maybe doesn't know that there are people looking at her trying to figure out what her connection is to any some man in the room, but like she's pretty brazen about it, and it leads to bad places. And I think that probably will be a pattern with her.
Yeah. A couple of character interactions that I think are worth noting. We talked about Damon and Sir Gerald, but there's also Damon and Lena Valerion. That is the young girl who has grown up a little bit in the many, many time jumps since episode 2. That a bit of a flirtation seems mm-hmm. to be occurring between the two of them, Richard.
Yes, yeah. And where that would go, I don't know. I mean, obviously, Damon and the Valerians were aligned a couple episodes ago, I guess still sort of technically are. It's kind of muddy where Damon stands in anyone's estimation, but like, clearly they still seem, you know, what was she dispatched by her father to do that? Like, are they just trying to cover all their bases? I don't know, but clearly this show is setting tables for what's to come in the back half of the season, and having that character kind of, you know, she's older now, she's clearly asserting a lot more agency. Like, that's again not an accident. I'm sure she will be another significant player going forward.
Sir Joffrey observes Kristen dutifully watching Rhaenyra, though perhaps it is just a little more than being her knight, her sworn protector. I think Joffrey recognizes within Kristen what is going on here, and he goes and speaks to him and thinks that they're speaking the same language of the future king is as dear to me as the future queen is to you. We'll guard them together. We can be in this together. This will be something that protects all of us. And Kristen is rigid and is unflinching in this moment. That will change very severely very soon. But this moment is just it's loaded with danger. In hindsight, it's just not that it wasn't awful to watch on the first pass for me, but in hindsight, this is just such a tragic scene of this sharing of information, this attempt at connection with this guy.
Yeah, and like, maybe I'm reading too much into it from a personal perspective, but like, it's also like a gay guy overstepping and thinking that he's safe, and you know, Kristen, you know, kind of being like, get away from, you know, like, it's very like, I'm not like you, you know, and we're not on the same path. We're not the same people. And obviously Joffrey suffers mightily for that. Granted, he was trying to do something slimy and sort of, you know, like, you know, sneaky and trying to, you know, already trying to court advantage, you know, in this new situation. So he's not 100% innocent in it, but I thought it was an interesting further development in Kristen's character, where like, he's not just some quietly handsome, you know, soldier in love. He's got a streak in him, a bad streak in him that clearly leads him into almost suicide.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it for me, it's like this whole scene, this whole coming together, a lot of this is, okay, well, you know, let's meet the family, right? You know, I've heard so much about you. And I think that there's a big element of that in Joffrey for me of, well, it seems like we're going to be spending a lot of time together, you know, kind of. And you're exactly right. He's talking to the exact wrong person. You know, he has no context for what the real relationship with Kristen and Rhaenyra is. And Kristen just, you know, is going to unload in this unbelievably horrific way in just a couple of moments.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we talked about this in the first episode where during the jousting, they talked about, and also later on when they're selecting, like, who will be the new member of the Kingsguard, like, that these boys, these young men, like, they haven't been to war. Kristen has seen battle in the Dornish incursion, so he has more experience than them. But a lot of the other young people in this scene or on this show, they're kind of just playing at this stuff. You know, they haven't, in their lifetimes, they haven't really seen the direst of consequences for this stuff. So I think it's an interesting demarcation point where it's like, Joffrey's just kind of like you know, a pampered lord of the court or whatever, and is
He was at the War of the Stepstones. He's very, very briefly in episode three, more, you know, a little more than background player, but he has 3 years of war. But I think, you know, broadly speaking, and in like the context of what is the culture of the kingdom, for sure.
But because that was adventurism. That was, you know, kind of gentlemen of the British Empire, like, oh, we'll have a merry old war and we'll go, you know, do this.
Yeah, and seek, you know, glorified.
Yeah. And now this is like, well, now this is about you specifically. And like, you are in danger and this is not stuff to be played with. And I think that, you know, Kristen is operating from a much, you know, more like visceral personal angst in this thing. But like, I think this is just like a crucial introduction that like, you are not safe at a fancy people's party anymore. You know, you're in danger when you're, you know, fighting, you know, battles on the beach or whatever, but like, you're kind of in danger all the time, and people are going to have to wake up pretty quickly to that fact.
Yeah, this is, you know, the proverbial a Stark goes south, right? You know, this is right. Like, just stay in the north. Don't come down here. So we're going to get this dance between Daemon and Rhaenyra now. I guess on the other side of a very quick dance between Rhaenyra and Breakbones, Sir Harwin Strong. They have a quick little do-si-do before Daemon cuts in. And once again, some high Valyrian exchanges between these two characters. And it feels like Daemon's last pitch of, is this really what you want? You really want to be married to, you know, a good man, you know, admittedly, but a boring one. This is how you want to move forward. And she tells him, well, then take me. Has that not been your purpose? I'm not married yet. The hours are passing. I'm sure you're armed. Cut through my father's Kingsguard. Take me to Dragonstone and make me your wife. And so there's this really, really tense conversation happening between the two of them in this language that is not shared exclusively by the two of them, but it feels that way sometimes. And Viserys is just pounding lobster or crab baby at his royal seat, watching this go down, you know, wrecked with all of the feelings that are swirling around this relationship from everything that he has heard recently, from everything that he feels independently towards these two people. And the view is obscured from him. And then from us, I would say, Richard, I don't know. I would really be curious to know, like, what was your view of how all of this ultimately goes to shit?
It felt sort of sudden. Do you mean like the kind of scuffle that ends with Joffrey dead? You mean?
Yes.
I mean, I think it's interesting that like it, when we realize something's happening, the camera's not on it happening, you know, at first it's sort of just like in this blur of people. And I think that, you know, I guess you could see something metaphorical in that about like, you know, this is going to start like, instantly, you know, like, and you're not going to necessarily see it coming. It's just going to not be happening where everyone's going to be dancing and having a party 1 minute, and the next year it's war, you know? And so that worked for me. And, you know, but going back to the Daemon and Rhaenyra conversation, it's like, yet again, I don't think she's thinking clearly about like the consequences of what she's saying and suggesting.
Yes.
And she's a little drunk on her prowess and her intellect. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, this thing breaks out that's going to have massive consequences. And, you know, I think it's pretty deliberate that we don't see it. We see the lead up to it, but then we cut away and then all of a sudden it's a catastrophe.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like anything could have set this off. It's a powder keg, right? Like the whole place was soaked in oil. All it would take, was wildfire even. Like it would take one match, one slowly burning candle to blow up the whole place. So it's almost presented to us, whether or not maybe some people out there would have preferred more clarity. I've gone back and forth on it myself a little bit, but I think that there is a world where the interpretation of how it's filmed and how it's presented to us, Richard, is kind of like, anything could have set this off. The candle was burning down all the way to the bottom, no matter what.
And you like then think forward to like the age of Daenerys and the Targaryens kind of exile in, you know, across the Narrow Sea. And you hear about the Mad King and all this stuff, and you're like, no wonder Westeros was like, get those Targaryens out of here. They only cause problems. Like, yeah, we want big, jolly, fat Robert Baratheon on the throne. He likes to hunt, and he was a war hero, and he got the Targaryens out. So, like that's so much better than these people who, they can't even have a simple party without some sort of dynastic power struggle leading to murder.
Yeah, well, it's like it's this grand game of King of the Hill, and the Targaryens have been the King of the Hill for the entirety of their arrival, you know, their reign since they've arrived. And I think a lot of what you see from the characters on the show in this period of time specifically, and then in Game of Thrones, we're living in the aftermath of it, is that we are dealing with people who want to cozy up to the King of the Hill. They want to make sure that they are on the winning side of this, and potentially get their chance to shine as well. So I think that so much of this show and the characters and their motivations and the stories that spiral out from them is rooted in this tremendous fear of who sits on the throne and the literal firepower that's backing them. And it does not come even remotely close to excusing the atrocities and the evil committed in the name of that fear. But I think that's, you know, it's power, it's fear. Fear is deeply rooted underneath a lot of the actions that happen, not just in this episode, but I think across the whole fabric of this entire franchise, really. And it sadly ends in this horrific death scene of Kristen Cole is going to take his rejection out specifically on Joffrey. He beats him to death in this very, very gruesome scene. We're left with Laenor wailing over his body. It's terrible. This is terrible.
And you kind of wonder, like, did Laenor just out himself? You know, like, I guess they could explain it away. No, it's just his dear friend since childhood. He was really sad about that. But it's like, I don't know. I think some of the men in that room would see that reaction and the wheels would start turning if they weren't already, you know? And so you wonder what lies ahead for Laenor. And then he's not covering up the fact that he's weeping at the wedding, you know?
Yeah.
That was a moment of perhaps really dangerous vulnerability on his part.
And I think that, you know, how can you forecast that this is going to be how the first night of your week-long wedding celebration is going to go, but this is sort of Rhaenys' prophecy fulfilled, right? You know, we're putting ourselves in danger. We're putting our son in danger. And she probably couldn't have even told you. It'll happen on the first night. On the first night, we will be in extraordinary danger. But here we are in extraordinary danger. And you're absolutely right that during the ceremony that ensues, he's destroyed. And Rhaenyra even senses that. You get the sense. I wonder what else you read into Rhaenyra, because she's such a more somber figure in the actual ceremony than she was throughout the entire party. It's like, is she like sobered up in the cold light of day? How did you read her reaction to everything?
I think so. Yeah. You know, and there
like,
are
oh
only...
shit, maybe I should have gone to Essos with Sir Criston Cole. Maybe he wouldn't have beaten a man to death in this horrific hate crime.
Yeah. I mean, that violence is not her fault ultimately, but...
Right.
But like it, I think, you know, there is a moment in any person's life when they're that age that they realize that they have an effect on the world around them, that they are not moving through just as these observers and sort of takers, that they are creating ripples of their own. And here she is realizing that, and also realizing that like she and Kristen aren't going to have his, you know, sort of dream of running away. They're certainly not now going to have the dream of he stays around and they just have a private affair, you know, for however long. It's like now they are forever separated, and that's one less protector, one less potential ally. And I think, I think she grows up quite a bit in the wake of that really bloody incident that, you know, she was in some ways involved with. Again, not to blame her for his, you know, unchecked merit, you know, anger, but like, you know, men would literally beat someone to death at a wedding then go to therapy kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But you know, I think that she's realizing like, oh, like I'm really in this now, and what I decide to do, the choices I make are going to have like really immediate effect. And I think that's a coming of age crucible of its own.
Yeah, absolutely. Sir Criston, who walks away from this ready to take his own life. He goes out to the Weirwood tree. He, you know, disarmors himself. He pulls out the dagger. He is about to do it. He is stopped by Queen Alicent. Alicent comes and finds him. Do you get the sense maybe she has figured out a use for this man at this point?
I don't know if she has a concrete use for him yet, but I think that she sees the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know, and I don't know that necessarily you could describe Kristen and Rhaenyra as enemies exactly yet, but like clearly they are apart. They have been torn apart. And I think Allison probably, you know, she's her father's daughter, sees some potential utility in that. He's also like a good at fighting, obviously. And, you know, he's not from a noble house, but he worked his way up. And yeah, I think that like she'll take anyone, and even if it's just to drive the knife into her former friend's side, you know, that much more, twist right. the knife that much more. So yeah, I think that's a really striking and surprising little scene there. And I, again, made me kind of that much more curious about where Allison's headed.
Final scene of the episode, final image is Viserys collapsing. He has been on he's been teetering on the edge of it the entire episode. He's been bleeding out the nose in the lead up to this specific moment. He falls down, everyone huddles over him, and straight out of The Departed, a rat scurries across the screen and is feasting on the blood that has fallen, that has been spilled on this night. A really, really grim ending to a very, very grim episode of House of the Dragon. As if there's another kind, though.
Yes, exactly. you know, and if this is the end of young Rhaenyra, young Allison, young Laenor, even. I'm really curious to see, you know, if we jump forward in time. Clearly, they'll have to kind of do some reverse exposition about what happened in the ensuing years, you know, or however long it's going to be. Because this moment doesn't look like it's going to lead to a sort of peace-ish for a while. It looks like things are about to fall apart all over again, because like everyone's just like got their hands
worse
on their swords
than ever.
Ready to, you know, but so, but if there is a time jump like that, I would think that would imply that things don't immediately go to ruin. I'm curious to see how they kind of get around that. That's a tricky narrative obstacle, and I'm curious how they're going to do it.
But I think that the episode, for me, anyway, really did feel like it had something of, maybe not on Game of Thrones, because typically a Game of Thrones finale can be a little quieter than this. But this, on another show, maybe had some season finale vibes to it.
Yeah.
I think you're right to mark that of, you know, feeling like it's the end of something. It certainly looks like it's the end of Viserys, but it looks like the end of a chapter of some kind that. Things have been in free fall for a long time on this show, really, from day dot. And every once in a while, a dragon swoops in and catches you, and you're flying for a minute before you fall off again. And right now, we leave this one, I think, falling without any real visible ledge to hang on to. It leaves me with a pit in my stomach, and I know where it's going. So it's a compelling moment in the story, I think, for the first season, for the freshman year of this really, really big show for HBO.
And I will be here for all the episodes coming. I don't have any more fancy film festivals
Hooray!
To go to, sadly.
Well,
so I will
be
here
till the bitter end. Knowing a little bit of what I know about what your travel schedule was like, Richard.
Yeah.
Good for you. I'm thrilled to have you back. This was really fun for me getting to talk to you about this episode and catching up on everything that's been happening on House of the Dragon up to this point. And it's been great catching up with all of you out there listening to the podcast. We hope that you've been enjoying it. So that's going to do it for us on Still Watching this week. Of course, as a reminder, you can write in stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We want to hear from you. If this is the end of an era of House of the Dragon, what do you think of book one, as it were? What do you think of this first arc of the show? Where do you think we are moving into the second movement of the show? All of that feedback, we would love to hear from you. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Richard, where can people find you? Anything you're working on that you want to plug?
Well, I tweet at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S. I have reviews and other things at vf.com, including a bunch of reviews from the Venice and Toronto Film Festival. So not exactly related to House of the Dragon, but, you know, the other side of my job can be easily found on vf.com.
Amazing. I'm at Round Howard, wherever you can find me on the internet, including right here, recapping House of the Dragon on vf.com every week. Also have a big book heavy article that is up on vf.com right now, talking about some of the stuff from the book, from the show that differs from each other, stuff that's very similar in this specific episode of episode 5 that if you want to check out, that's vf.com, the House of the Dragon coverage there that you can investigate. further. Before we close out, I want to give a big shout out to the great Dave Gonzalez, who lights the way for us here on Still Watching Behind the Scenes, makes it possible for these episodes of Still Watching to exist. So big thanks to Dave. And big thanks to all of you out there for listening. We will be back next week talking about episode 6 of House of the Dragon. Until next time, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.